syllables. The most challenging, some letters. One of the most challenging things to have to deal with in Jewish thinking, and the truth is in life in general, is the subject of simcha, of happiness. And this this time of year is a focus on being happy, the Zman Simcha Seinu, idea of transcending the problems, the mundane at least, sometimes more than that, into some situation of simcha, of happiness. And obviously if we're going through that zone right now, then this has to be the learning ground which enables us to relate to the idea of simcha. So let's see if we can try and work out together some of what the Torah attitude or insight is to the subject of being happy. And then, if we have time, try to see how it relates to being in a sukkah, how we learn it from this, and how that can penetrate into the rest of what it is that we have to be doing. So, a few remarks that we have to make by way of introduction are, first of all, you see that there is a central current of thinking in the West, in Western thinking, which is that happiness is a goal. That means that if you had to sum up the attitude towards life, or the drive, central drive that the West grasps or that the West espouses, then they would probably say that it's a search for happiness. I imagine, I think if you look in the literature, the modern literature and media, you'd probably find that either there's an explicit, maybe we should talk about ordeals. You'll find that there's an explicit philosophy which is the search for happiness, and if you don't find it as explicit, you'll certainly find that what they do is search for happiness by one or other method of distraction or drunkenness, whether it's literal, physical, or psychological, emotional. But there's a situation of trying to get into a non-pain zone, at least a comfort zone, and hopefully more than that. And yet you don't find that in Torah the idea of happiness is an objective at all. You do find statements that seem to suggest that, and we'll try and look at them, but authentically, authentically in Torah thinking, you don't find that there's a goal which is to be happy as an endpoint. We don't look for that. Yet it's a mitzvah to be happy. Let's see if we can work this out together. First of all, you know that we just came out of a situation just before getting into the sukkah, we read the klalos, we read the Torah's list of curses that will befall the Jewish people as a group, as a nation. They do this deliberately? There's a list of curses that the Torah lays out for what will be the consequences, what will happen to us if we fall away from our spiritual path. And fascinatingly, at the very end of the list of curses, right very close to the end, it gives a reason. And this is a classic source that is very seriously misunderstood. And the reason for the curses is, the Torah says, Tachas es ha-shaloi, because you did not serve Hashem with happiness. You weren't happy. And this is a source that's often quoted as being the Torah's stipulation, the Torah's delineating the idea of happiness as a goal, and that we're accountable to be happy, and that there are tremendous punishments for not being happy. That's what it seems to suggest. There's a whole list of 98 or 99 or 100 curses, and then it says you're going to be cursed with all these unspeakable horrors that will befall you as a nation because you weren't happy. That's what it seems to say. That seems to be a very clear indication, a very clear Torah source for the mitzvah, the command to be happy. There are other statements. For example, you have Ivdes Hashem B'Simcha. Right? We sing that. Ivdes Hashem B'Simcha means serve Hashem in happiness. And one interpretation is serve Him with being happy. That means that the service lies in the happiness. The loose translation means that you should serve in joy. It means that when you are serving Hashem, that you're doing the mitzvahs, you're learning Torah, you're living as a Jew, a spiritual human being, so then you should be happy. That at least sounds like the objective is to be happy. And some interpret it to mean that the service that you should perform is through the happiness. It means you want to know what Torah service is, how you serve Hashem, it's by being happy. And we have statements, mitzvah gedolah liyos besimcha, tomid, it's a great mitzvah to be happy always. The Chazon Ish writes in one of his letters, it's worth looking at. The Chazon Ish writes in one of his letters, you can look it up in the collected writings, the collected letters, the Igros of the Chazon Ish, I think it's number 62 or 63. Over there, a short letter that he writes to someone, he ends off by saying that the emes, that means in truth, lemishe makir, somebody who knows, oira, oira shala emes, somebody who knows the light of the lights of truth, ein etzev ba'olam. There's no such thing as sadness. I mean, the Chazon Ish is saying that if you know the truth that underlies the world's existence, it's not possible to be sad. Now, the Chazon Ish doesn't mean, we have to know what he means. What he's talking sadness there is more in the sense of etzev, in the sense of atzvus, meaning depression, because sadness sometimes is a mitzvah. It means you have a mitzvah of mourning sometimes. We're not talking about being, that could be a mitzvah, but sadness in the sense of depression. It means that enervating, despairing mode, right, that we call, in the English parlance, we call depression, that there's no question that, first of all, it's never allowed. It's never allowed. It's a very serious transgression, certain sense. And there's no cause for that ever. Depression meaning, not talking here about chemical problems, we're talking here about functional problems, not medical problems. The being depressed as a response to one's circumstance, depressed meaning despairing, and having that feeling of no place to go and things not being worth it, that's a completely un-Jewish response. But he's telling us that somebody, that happiness is such a central aspect of Torah that somebody who understands the world correctly could never not be happy. That means that he's telling you that even in a mitzvah of mourning, for example, there has to be an underlying happiness, a remarkable thing. The commentaries say that to express happiness openly is inappropriate. That means there's a halacha that a Jew is not allowed to laugh fully. It's halachically required that your laughter has to be repressed. That means it has to be at least limited. That we don't laugh with a completely, there's a tremendous amount of sadness in the world, tremendous amount of suffering, let's use that word, and therefore to laugh with complete abandon would be insensitive. And therefore, it has to be somewhat limited. But we say, as yamala ischok pinu, that means that, but when we transition into the real situation, the messianic revelation, or a world that doesn't have suffering, then our mouths will be filled with laughter. Now the commentaries learn from that if our mouths will be filled with laughter, it means that until then they may not be full. Partially full, mostly full, but not complete, not absolute abandon. But that's only the expression of happiness. That means that a Jew is not allowed to laugh with complete abandon in the world. But to feel it in the heart, absolutely you should. That means no matter what a person is going through, there should never be a lack of that fullness of simcha. Now what does that mean? First of all, how is it possible? And secondly, what exactly does it mean? And what does the Torah mean when it says that there's a mitzvah of happiness? When the Torah says that you're being cursed with all these curses because you weren't happy, well, what does that mean if not that your prime obligation is to be happy? There are plenty of Torah sources that say it's not that. Perhaps deeper, we need to ask ourselves this. And that is, how is it possible to be happy, even partially and even temporarily? The world is so full of suffering, of genuine agony. How can anybody find it possible to just be happy? We have to be tremendously insensitive to do that. You know, if you have any awareness of what's going on in the world, not far from here, especially here maybe, but there's so many parts of the world where there's gross, wholesale, butchery and torture, tremendous human suffering, indescribable human suffering. The truth is that if there's even one human being suffering in such a fashion, how can anybody else be fully happy? You have to be tremendously sensitive to do that. Let's freeze it at a Jewish level for a moment. Never mind, let's not look at the world's problems in general, although if you're human, you have to feel that. But as a Jew, the Jews who are, who doesn't have somebody close to them in their family, at least connected somehow to their family situation, if not immediately, but in a slightly, in a secondary fashion, somebody who's going through some tremendous loneliness or tremendous illness or some torment or other, who can say they don't know anybody like that? So you know someone who's going through that kind of suffering. And even if you don't know them personally, but you know they are. There are hospitals full of people, there's old age homes full of people, there's institutions, there's families, there's marriages, half the marriages in Jewish life are fractured. Half the marriages are either fractured or going through fragmentation. It's a tremendous pain what that does to the children involved. The mystical, the deeper sources say that if you study the world well, you come to understand that there's never been one good day in the history of the world. Never mind a lot of suffering going on, there's never been one good day. The first day, the first man blew it. Right? He had a few hours to correct it, and in those few hours he managed to wreck it. So that means he didn't even exist for more than a moment. The Midrash says at 10 o'clock in the morning shape was gathered together. At 11 he was shaped into the human form. At 12 life was breathed into him, and at 1 he sinned. It says 1 hour of consciousness before he, and at the next hour he stood in judgment, the next hour he's exiled from the garden. So the first day was not even an hour of potential perfection. And from then on, one suffering after another. What generation of Jews hasn't been through defamation and brutality and torment and torture? One way or another, some part of the world. Some sources say that the only time there was ever a suggestion of perfection was in the 40 years of the reign of King Solomon. Shlomo HaMelech was the 15th generation, when the moon was full, as it were, in Jewish history, and there were no wars. He was a man of complete peace and fullness and completion, and the Jewish people were at peace. And even then, the Gemara says, even then, that the day the Beis HaMikdash was built, on the day that the temple was completed and dedicated, on that day, the angel Gabriel, representing the side of Hashem's retribution or justice, let's say, he descended and planted a stake in the Mediterranean that later became the island, the country of Italy, of Rome, from which destruction, that means that in the moment of the temple's being founded, the moment of its destruction was being planted. That means the seed of its own destruction was born within its own creation. So that there's not a moment of human happiness that doesn't carry its own death within it. And if that's the human condition, then it's been the human condition since the creation, and certainly in the modern and limited world, there's not an individual who can say that he's completely free of somebody certainly close and certainly more distant that isn't going through some suffering. How can you be happy? How can you be happy? So you're going to go out for dinner. How are you going to be happy exactly? You're going out for dinner with some friends with a bottle of wine. Are you going to sit there and you're going to laugh with complete abandon while there are people that you personally know are going through death? You have to be tremendously insensitive to do that. Is that what's required of us? Do you have to forget the sadness? Of course, in the secular world, that is the concept of happiness. The concept of happiness is some kind of drunkenness, which means forgetfulness. That's what they do. They drown their awareness of suffering by forgetting about it, either with alcohol or with some other trick of consciousness so that they can... But that's tremendously insensitive. That's being human. That's what it means. You have to forget about that. That's a betrayal. It's a betrayal of your humanity to do that. So the question is, what is this thing then? And what is it? So where do you find happiness? And how is it a mitzvah to be happy? And why does the Torah say that you're being punished for not being happy? What does that mean? And if this Hashem b'simcha, there's so many commandments, so many phrasings, it seems, of this obligation to be happy. What does it mean? So let's see if we can try and work it out. Just at least begin to work it out together. Now, the idea is like this. The Torah attitude to happiness is that it's not a forgetting of sadness. On the contrary, it could be that the greatest ability to achieve happiness, the depth of it, is within the suffering. It's with the sharpest awareness of suffering, not a forgetfulness. See if you can try and find the words to make it clear. The Torah idea of happiness is that we never seek it as a goal. In fact, it's one of those paradoxical areas that when you seek it, it always recedes. You ever notice that? When you're trying to be happy, go out and try to be happy. That's the surest recipe for becoming depressed. When you are happy, it's not when you're trying to be. It's when you're doing something useful, you may be lucky and be happy while you're doing it. But when you are trying to be happy, it's one of those things. There's a number of things in life that when you chase them, like honor, the person who wants to be honored, the only way you can have genuine honor is when you flee from it. That's a chazal. When you chase it and you want to be honored, you become a ludicrous, you become a laughing stock, you become despised. When you genuinely flee it, that means the only way to achieve it is if you genuinely don't want it. There's once a man came to the Chazon Ish and he said, you know, I've been fleeing from honor all my life and it still hasn't found me. The Chazon Ish said, no, you're looking over your shoulder, that's the problem. You have to genuinely not want it before it finds you. And happiness is one of those paradoxical areas that the truth is that the sharpest happinesses in life are over. It means that in the sharpest experience of a happiness, there's the awareness that the next moment will bring about the disintegration of that happiness. You cannot... What the Torah means, and this is the secret, right? This is the secret. What the Torah means when it talks about happiness and the mitzvah to be happy, it means not to be happy as a goal. It means to be happy as a means. The idea of happiness in Torah is not that you try to be happy. The idea in Torah is that you try to do what you have to do. But the method that you have to use to get there, you know, let's try and make it clearer. The purpose of being is not to be happy. The purpose of being is to work. To work, right? To serve, service, to be an Eved Hashem, to serve Hashem, to work. The paradox, however, is that in the correct working, in correct service, where genuine happiness is to be found. You know, if you look carefully at the words, it's so obvious. When the Torah goes through all the curses and then says, because you weren't happy, the words, if you read them carefully, because you didn't serve in happiness. The Torah doesn't say because you were not happy, meaning because you didn't walk around with a fixed grin, right? Stretched into the skin of your face. That's not what the Torah says. Because you didn't serve in happiness. The prime obligation is the service. Now that you're serving, you should have enjoyed it. The service is a building, and in serving and building, you should have felt the pleasure of what it means to be building. That you didn't do, so there wasn't a service and there wasn't a happiness. The Torah is not telling you to walk around forgetting that there's sadness, or drunk with some kind of forgetfulness. And by the way, all of the commandments, you know, that says, Ibdus Hashem b'simcha, serve Hashem in happiness. It doesn't say be happy. It says serve in happiness. That's the beginning of the verse. The beginning of the verse is you have to be serving. When you're working and building, you know, if you want an analogy from the crude and lowly, coarse and unrefined, senseless modern context, it would be an individual in a gymnasium trying to build muscle. Right? If anybody would ever consider such a fruitless and gorilla-like activity, then imagine someone who is pushing weights in the gymnasium trying to look masculine. So... But if you watch such an individual, you'll find a remarkable thing. What he's doing is working. What he's doing is working. But paradoxically, the people who do that enjoy it. If you would go to one of those gymnasiums and you look through the keyhole, you see an individual picking up weights or struggling against some machine, right? With the most extreme exertion, pouring sweat, shaking with exertion, grunting and groaning, and you would be sure that just out of your range of vision was someone with a submachine gun forcing him to do this activity. But if you were allowed into the room, you would see that there's no one forcing him, and he's not paying for he's paying to be allowed to do this thing, right? Which is ridiculous, isn't it? But the reason that he's enjoying it is because what he wants is the building, and in pushing against resistance is his sense of building, and what he's enjoying is the work. The reason he's enjoying it is because there's a goal. He's moving towards some place that he wants to get to. And therefore, the harder the work is, the more the pleasure. It's a remarkable thing. People become addicted to that pleasure. That's a lowly analogy, but it's the analogy of struggling. And therefore, the Jewish neshama grasps ordeals and relishes life ordeals as the challenges that are the pushing against the weights of the spiritual world so that you build what genuine content is. Now that doesn't mean that you walk around grinning when you enter an ordeal, when a person's marriage is in trouble, or a person is having trouble getting married, or relationships are floundering, or a person has personal difficulties, or financial, whatever they are. Doesn't mean the person walks around grinning in a silly fashion because the Torah wants him to be happy through ordeals. That's unrealistic, and it's not. That's not what's meant. But what is meant is just like a person pushing the weights is grimacing with the pain of working because he wants. So similarly, when a person's grimacing with the pain of working through human ordeals, but emunah means knowing that underlying this is an eternity that's being built. That the transition from the finite to the eternal is taking place in the moment of greatest suffering. That's what a person has to know. You know that when a person reaches his goal, when this person becomes the world champion athlete in that particular field, right, whatever it is, he's the fastest, whatever it is, or the most gorilla-like individual on the stage in that particular lineup of... So then, when he wins that prize or that crown, what makes him happy in that moment is the relishing of the work that was put in to get there. That's what it is. There's a mature grasp of the hours and hours and hours of dedicated suffering that it took, or the months or the years of suffering that it took to get to that point. Anybody who's ever exerted himself in Torah learning will know. That the enlightenment of breaking through a sugya, the Gemara, Torah, the enlightenment in proportion to the effort that it took to get there. There's an experience of growth that a person feels, and it's in direct proportion. In fact, it is the work itself. And therefore, the correct grasp of the dimension of happiness from a Torah perspective is that it's in the agony. It's in the dimension of ordeal. It's in the dimension of work. It's knowing that the world is full of suffering. And it's being involved in that suffering. That's where happiness lies. It's a remarkable idea. The happiness means the knowledge that this very difficulty is the transition into transcendence. You know that the innate response we have, you know that we have a concept, a deep idea in Torah, that every idea that's true in the spiritual world we resonate with emotionally. That means we're able to connect with it in the emotions. Right? When something happens, we grasp something that's true, we resonate, we have an emotion that feeds off that thing or feeds into that thing, and it's a sure barometer, it's a sensitive indicator of knowing that thing's true and correct. What are the experiences in life that generate happiness? You'll notice that when a person feels happy, genuine happiness, not talking about the drunken kind, although we'll have to talk about that as well, it is connected, is a moment when a person transcends from a limited situation into an unlimited situation, or at least a less limited situation, when there's an expansion of the consciousness involved in going from one stage to another, or one situation to another. There's a sense of expanse. When people, you know that situations that generate happiness also generate a sense of expanse. A person's horizons become broader. Situations of negativity close in one's horizons. Situations of depression, let's say, or sadness, they close in horizons. Situations, yes, there's an isolationist feeling, you become withdrawn, as opposed to when a person's going through happiness, let's say they're going through a tremendous a wedding, a chasana of themselves, a child, let's say, somehow what happens in one's consciousness is that people start becoming linked to your own being, other people. Suddenly your arms reach out, and you become enabled to embrace, and sometimes people in those situations embrace very closely people that they really weren't that close to before. But are you with me? In that moment, there's an ability to reach out. There's an expanded, the self expands. It's a remarkable thing. On the contrary, I'll try and speak about that as well. That's a deep idea. At the opposite layer later, when a person's suffering, so there's an inability to connect outwards. By the way, part of the mitzvah of to be menachem somebody, when somebody's in almost inconsolable type of sadness, we go to be part of that. We have to do it with sensitivity, but the reason we do it is that we can draw them out of the limited self, then we can draw away some of that sadness by pulling them outward. Simcha means, somebody mentioned here a question, try and explain that the word simcha, the very word simcha, means, you have, if you have the head and the energy to concentrate on something a little bit deeper for a moment, so if you hear this well, the idea of simcha, the word itself, indicates an expansion from the finite borders into that which transcends the finite. You know that the word simcha is the same letters as chamisha, as five. And the Maharal explains that the idea of five is always the idea of taking four, which is always the limited world. Four is always the four dimensions of the world. Right? What in English we call two dimensions. Right? In Torah we always call it four, by which we mean front and back, left and right. Right? We're talking about the four corners of the earth, right? The dimensions that cover the physical plane. Those are the four dimensions of limitation. When you add an extra dimension, when you take those four and give them the ability to connect into that which transcends the finite, so that's called five. For example, a dalet in Hebrew. You know the letter dalet, which means four, is a dalet is two lines, right, which is two dimensions. And a hay, which is five, is just one dot of ink that's added in the center. That infinitesimal dimensionless center, that dot, which transforms the limited four of the finite world into that which is enabled, that already becomes what's called five, chamisha. And what was mentioned here, if you take it, this is not tonight's subject directly, but I'll just mention it in passing, that's the word simcha. The word for six in Hebrew, which transcends five, is shesh. Shesh is really sas. The same word in Hebrew, sason. Sason is a higher dimension than simcha. Simcha is a happiness that's the transition from finite to super finite, super finite. Sason is an expansion beyond that. That is a fullness that's more than just transcending. It's a leaping into that world of transcendence. The word seven in Hebrew, shiva, actually spells svi'ah, which means complete fullness. It's not only leaping beyond the finite into something else. It's not only getting, but it's totally filling both worlds. That's already shiva. And it goes on. The word shmona in Hebrew, which means eight, actually is based on shamein, which means fat. Fatness means that there's not only the fullness of the meat on the bones, but there's that which is already expanding beyond the essential, that's already transcendence, which is why 8 in Hebrew is always the miraculous, the priest is on the 8th day, Hanukkah's 8th day, 9 is very deep, and 10 is Eser in Hebrew, is already Ashir. The word Ashir, Eser, Ashir, Ashir means richness, that's not only having more than you need, but enough to give as well, that's already Ashir. So the numbers actually, but that's another subject. But the idea of Chamisha, of 5, is the idea of leaping beyond the four, the two-dimensional world, or what we would call four dimensions, into that. And therefore happiness is a sense, not a sense of forgetting sadness, it doesn't say that any place, not at all. But it's, if a person knows how to do it, and that's what the Chazanish means, if a person knows how to transcend even from the depths of the saddest of experiences, a person knows that when the world seems to be ultimately limited, when a person comes up against what seem to be insurmountable ordeals, right? But the correct handling of those ideals is that in that moment, the most difficult of ordeals and the most painful of human experiences are the essence of what one's life is in the next world. Not the times when it was easy. The times when a person experienced easy path in life, those fall away in the next world. Because the next world is only built out of the effort that you put in. The next world is all ecstasy. The next world is, the Ramchal says that the next world is created only for an ecstatic experience. And the only way you get that ecstasy is through the difficulty of this world. So a person understands that. That's what the Chazanish means. A person could go through a world like this and witness a Holocaust, and loss of who knows what. And in that, the Chazanish says that such a person who understands the truth of the world could never possibly be sad. Chazanish means the person's impervious to suffering? Of course not. The person doesn't weep? Of course he weeps. But he knows that in the moments that cause the deepest weeping, in those moments he's built an eternity of ecstasy. That's a remarkable thing. Remarkable thing. Depression is the opposite. Depression means that letting that world of sadness close in so you don't see a growth here. So that's a death experience. You know that any moment of transition, what can I tell you? You know, if you look in Torah, you see so many examples. Let's just spend 1 or 2 minutes try to seek out 1 or 2 examples. You know that when you look at the finite world, this idea is so beautiful it's almost inexpressible. You know, when you look at the finite world, what could be a deeper indication of the finite than the system of measurement? Feet and inches, centimeters, meters. Right? In the Torah, what we talk about, the tefach, a hand's breadth, an amma, a cubit. Right? You have a set of measurements. Remarkable thing about in Torah, when you talk about hand's breadth, you have to talk about which kind of hand's breadth do you mean. There's called the tefach atzuf, a sad tefach, And there's a thing called the tefach samach. It's happy. And the tefach samach is a little bit broader than the tefach atzuv. There's two kinds. You hear that? There's a tefach atzuv is a handspring. Tefach samach is where the fingers are separated slightly like a smile. And it's just a bit broader. You hear that? There's an amma, for example. You have an amma, which is a cubit. You have to say which amma is he talking about. In the description in Tanakh of the third temple, the third Beis HaMikdash, where the measurements are given, there's a whole learned discussion about which ammas are intended over there. Which ammas? Are you talking about the sad ones or the happy ones? Now, what engineer in his right mind would devise a system of measurements that are, you know, happy and sad? Now, when they're sad, they contract, and when they're happy, they expand. You know, how can you build with us? But the secret is deep. The secret is that since Torah is the description of the world, so that inherent in the world of measurements, in the world of measurement, that means that which defines the finite, that which limits the finite ultimately, the system of measurement, what could be more limiting than that? There's two ways to grasp it. There's a sad way, when the thing is what it is, and no more. Then there's a happy, a gap between the fingers, it starts to smile. And that's called happy, a remarkable thing. When the Torah wants to talk about a measurement that expands beyond its minimal dimensions, so we talk about a measurement that gets a remarkable thing. But somebody understands what we're talking about this evening deeply will understand that that's exactly where it is. It's in the being finite. It's in the closing in of the finite world of ordeal and of pain and of suffering and of human difficulty and of your greatest inabilities and disabilities. It's there exactly. There exactly that if a person grasps it as what it's what it is and it's sad. It's tremendously finite and limited. And it's a death world. And a person grasps that in that world of difficulty, that's where the world of expansion of transcendence is being built. You know that in Torah, this is what we use wine for. In the secular world, remarkable, if you ever want to know the difference in the Jewish world and the non-Jewish world, right? If you're in this generation, the distinctions are extremely blurred. Extremely blurred. But one of the places you can still see it is in the relationship that we have with wine. Now that in the non-Jewish world, wine is handled in one of two ways, by and large. By and large. It's either completely overindulged, right? Or completely avoided. Completely avoided, in an ascetic sense, completely. Either overindulged, right? I saw not so long ago in a medical journal a report, a survey that was done in a city hospital in Boston. They investigated how many people admitted to that hospital were admitted as a direct result of alcohol, and they found that 50% of admissions to that hospital were alcohol-related. Either cirrhosis, or violence-related, or driving accidents, trauma, somehow related to alcohol. Remarkable thing. Not 50%. They either overindulge, it's a well-known thing in the world, in secular world, or they become tremendously ascetic. Muslims, for example, are not allowed to own alcohol. Never mind drink it. I know, because on Pesach, a couple of years ago, I had a few bottles of whiskey that I didn't want to throw out for Pesach. Then my father-in-law, Lashon, used to come around and say, drink a whiskey. So I wasn't going to pour them out. So what was I going to do with them? So I went down to the Arab town near where I live, thinking that since they're not allowed to drink their alcohol, it'll be a great deal. I'll sell them the whiskey, and I'll come back a week later, and I'll buy it back from them. It'll be safe because they're not allowed to drink it. They told me they're not allowed to own it. They couldn't buy it from me because they're not allowed to own it. I had to go and find a Christian workshop someplace where they tried to convert me, so I never went back after that. But the point is that they're not allowed to own it. So there's either a tremendous asceticism, or there's an overindulgence in it. But in the Jewish world, what Jewish community had age restrictions on alcohol? In most, for all its liberal nature, when I was last in America, I think there's still some states that have a 21-year-old age restriction on drinking wine, or 18. What? But in Jewish life, you ever have a problem with alcohol? When do we take alcohol? Remarkable thing. So wine is our connection. In Jewish life, wine is the connection between the finite world and the transcendent world. And wine is that which, used correctly, generates that kind of happiness. What sort of happiness? It's the happiness of releasing the hidden dimension within the finite dimension. You know that Chazal said, "Nichnas yain yatzah sod." When the wine goes in, the secret comes out. So of course it means it at a simple level, but it also means it deeper. When wine goes in, it releases the secret world. Wine, yayin, yud yud nun, adds up to 70. And the secret world, the world of the hidden world, sod, adds up to 70. That's the connection in the words. But when the wine goes in, the deeper world, the secret world, comes out. When do we take wine? And wine is remarkable. Wine is that which comes out of the grape. That means that you have here a physical phenomenon in the world, handled a certain way, it develops the ability to bring out another dimension. That means affects consciousness. Handled correctly, it will bring out a tremendous expansion of consciousness. Handled incorrectly, it will make you tremendously physical. It will amplify the physicality. Enough wine, a person will become part of the scenery. It will make you, right, animalize the transcendent instead of help the animal to transcend. When do we take wine? So in Jewish life, we take wine at all moments of transcendence. When do we take a cup of wine? Remarkable thing. Why do we stand with a cup of wine? You're getting married. It's time to hold a cup of wine. What's it got to do with getting married? Or Shabbos comes in. Right? Now the week is transitioning to Shabbos. You got to do it with wine? We're used to it, so we don't question it. What does that mean? A bris. A child is having a bris milah, being circumcised. You have a cup of wine? What's going on? Wine's the central focus that we make the blessings on all these occasions. Right? We're taking, and the idea is beautiful. The idea is that all these are moments of the physical world transcending into the superphysical. When a couple get married, what's happening is two physical bodies are being put together here as the nucleus for that which is a love, an intense human experience, that which is going to build more than the two of them, that which is going to build a family. I've been talking about here about Jewish continuity, talking about, so that moment of transitioning between the individual finite world and the transcendent world of Judaism and its movement through the generations, that's exactly when wine is bris milah, circumcision. You're taking here the most physical aspect of the human being and giving it the sensitivity, giving it the world, giving it the complement that it needs to transcend into the world of higher values. That's the time to take a cup of wine. Or Shabbos. What is the moment of Kiddush when you're making Kiddush on Friday night? Isn't it when the finite world of the week transitions into the higher level of Shabbos? So that's exactly when wine. I know it's going through your mind, and it certainly should be. And that's Havdalah. Havdalah, perhaps more beautifully than anything, says what we're trying to say this evening. You hear the question. Havdalah is when you take Shabbos and you go into the week. So there we're descending. We're going out of the world of Kiddush. We're going down into the mundane. So how can we take a cup of wine? The wine of Havdalah marks the transition. Just like we greet Shabbos with a cup of wine, we witness its exit with a cup of wine. So the question that was asked here is, that seems the opposite. We're saying here that, are we together? We're saying that wine is the vehicle, right? It's the focus of the moment of transition from the finite into that which transcends the finite. So then how come Havdalah, which is the experience of going from the finite back, from the transcendent, the infinite, back into the finite, take wine? But the answer is very, very beautiful. The question is good and the answer is better. And the answer is, that what happens in Havdalah, when a person moves from Shabbos into the week, is a moment of tremendous elevation. And the reason is, it's what the mystical sources call the Yirida Tzorech Aliyah. It's a going down for the purpose of going up. The idea of going out of Shabbos into the week, a person makes a very bad mistake if they think that Shabbos is a high and they descend into the week. And next Shabbos they high and they descend into the week. And next Shabbos, that's a terrible mistake. Terrible mistake. That's not the way it works. Shabbos is a high. And you descend into the week so you can get higher the next Shabbos. That's why you're stepping down into the week. The whole point of living that Shabbos is to live what it means. To live what it means to be at a higher plane that the work of the week brought you to. After you absorb what that means, you deliberately step out into a week so you can build another Shabbos. If every Shabbos is no higher than the previous one, you're rolling on towards death. That's not a growth experience. Every Shabbos says, are you with me? That's what it is. All the dips in life, all the movements out of moments of ecstasy and transcendence are steps into moments of ordeal that enable you to get back to a high that's more intense and more mature and more developed than the previous peak of experience. That's what it's for. And therefore, when we have dual emotions, we move out of Shabbos. We take the spices that we smell in order to take the flagging, the neshama that feels the sense of pain of having left the world of Kedushin that's moving down into the finite. But at that same moment is the muscles of the neshama grasping the weights to begin picking up the weights so that the spiritual muscle will be built to a higher peak than they were 7 days before. And that's what the wine is. It's tremendous. That's the real wine of happiness. Moving from the week into Shabbos is a movement of is a movement from the world of work into the world of reward. That's what Shabbos is. That's what Shabbos is. It's a flash of the next world. But moving from Shabbos into the week, that's a higher sense of exhilaration. That's a sense of taking the experience of Shabbos and taking the elevation that it's given you to work, to move into the world of ordeal and struggle and work and building, and to use that to get to a point that definitely has to be higher than the previous Shabbos. Let's just try and finish with a minute of insight into what this has to do with Yom Tov. Sukkah, so what's it got to do with being in a Sukkah and Yom Tov? Why do we have a mitzvah of being happy on a Chag, on a Yom Tov? What? Shabbos, you don't have a mitzvah of being happy. Shabbos is not a time of happiness. Shabbos, a mitzvah is Oneg. Oneg means a certain kind of pleasure. It's Menucha, means a certain kind of rest, a sensation of endpoint, work during the week, reaching an endpoint on Shabbos. But the time of happiness, that means to generate specific happiness. That's what a Yom Tov is. That's what it is. A mitzvah to generate happiness in certain ways. How does it fit with what we're saying? We don't have time to go into it in detail, but let's just try and say at least one word about it. Although what we've said already is the main part of the discussion. And that is that there's a beautiful section in the Maharal where he talks about the idea that Yom Tov is, I'm going to digest it and present it to you briefly because there's a lot more complexity to it. A lot more halachic complexity also, but in a nutshell, he says the most fascinating idea. You know that we have a concept that the weekdays are parallel to this world, and Shabbos is parallel to the next world. That's a well-known parallel. Moving through the week and moving towards Shabbos is a microcosm of moving through the work of this world to reach a state of Shabbos, which is the next world. Many, many parallels. It's a fascinating discussion. The things that we do on Friday are similar to the things that we do later when somebody dies. You know that? Just like when someone leaves this world and transitions into the next, we trim their nails and they're dressed in white and they get washed. Similarly on Fridays, right, on when we move Shabbos, we move into Shabbos, we also have a mitzvah to be trimmed, clean, dressed in white, washed, and very many parallels, halachic parallels. Shabbos is ma'en olam haba, it's like moving into the world of reward. And that's of course why Shabbos is a time of non-activity, non-building. On Shabbos what we do is we feel what we've built during the week. We don't build new things. Right? One may not build the world on Shabbos. The week is where you build things. Shabbos is a time of bringing it home, of feeling, consolidating or enjoying the feeling of what it is that one has become, one's family has become, one's spiritual development has reached, point that it's reached. That's what Shabbos is. So the question that has to be answered is, fascinating question. If the days of the week are parallel to this world, and Shabbos is parallel to the next world, then what is Yom Tov parallel to? What's a Yom Tov? You have Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot. You have a Yom Tov, you have a Chag. So what's that parallel to? If are you with me? You've got weekdays, Yom Tov, and Shabbos. If the weekdays are parallel to this world, and Shabbos is parallel to the next world, you've got it all covered. So what's Yom Tov parallel to? And Maral explains a fantastic idea. And he says that Yom Tov is parallel to the Messianic age. Isn't that beautiful? You have this world, a transition zone which is known as Yemos HaMashiach, when the Mashiach arrives in a physical setting, and then a transition into the final situation. What is the nature of the Messianic age? A long discussion. But in a nutshell, there are commentaries who explain that the world of the Mashiach, the days during which the Mashiach will walk the earth and will be here together with him in a finite and physical sense, is a phase of being able to... Briefly, it's like this. You know, let's say a person puts in their effort to develop, right? They learn Torah as much as they can, do mitzvahs, they work on their personality, they do everything they can. The limitations, the world limits you. You may have handicaps that limit you, you may have financial constraints, you may have to learn less than you want to because of the need to make a living. Constraints, not things beyond your control. The depth of it is to use those as growth experiences. But nevertheless, a person might want to do more, a person should want to do more. Hashem gives the Messianic age, let's say 1,000 years, of opportunity to maximize your potential to its absolute peak pitch of perfection before you enter the next world. You hear that? First you have a world of work, that's this world. then before transitioning into the final situation of the next world, he gives you a chance to take your potential and lift it to its absolute maximum, so that when it's frozen forever in the dimension that we call the next world, it will be maximized. And you get 1,000 years, whatever it is, the messianic age, you get that time to be able, with no impedance at all, nothing impeding your growth, tremendous rocket-powered ability to maximize all your potential. There's one catch, though. The catch is, the reward is only for the phase. Let's put it this way. He says like this: you can only work at those things that you started before. You can't start anything new. Not when it's all easy and given and it's all rocket-powered energy and it's all plain. There's no new beginnings. Anything that you opened up when it was difficult, you then get a free gift of the time to maximize it. And that's the parallel to Yontif. On Shabbos you can't cook. What can you cook on Shabbos? You didn't cook it, you don't eat it. On Yontif you can cook, but only if you lit the fire before. If the fire's been lit on Erev Yontif, on Yontif you can cook. You can bring, yeah, the halachic parallel. It's more complex than that, deals with Erev Tavshilin over there, but that's the general idea. So you have this phase. So what is Yontif? It's the gen, and that is where Simcha lies. Isn't that amazing? Shabbos is not Simcha. Shabbos is Menucha. And of course that's why the reward is only paid out. The reward you get is not the reward for what you do when it's rocket powered and easy. The reward, that is the reward. You don't get your reward for that. The reward is for what you started when it was difficult, and when it looked the opposite, and when you were handicapped, and when you were laughed at for doing it, and when it hurt and burned. And that's the reward that you get for that, is that there'll come a day when you'll be given the opportunity to maximize that with no resistance at all, and that itself will be its own reward. That's Yom Tov. You see what Yom Tov is? The transition zone. The transition zone between the finite, limited world of pain and work, and the final zone of Shabbos, which is rest and pleasure of reward. It's the opportunity of sensing growth, right? Of sensing maximum growth. And that's where happiness is. Remarkable thing. When the Torah places happiness, where does it put it? Into Yom Tov. What is Yom Tov? What is it? And Sukkot is the time when we feel it maximally, because Sukkot is the time when you see Hashem's Hashkocha. The idea of Sukkot is the idea of moving out of the finite world. Those thick concrete walls that you live in the rest of the year, they are a big cushion between you and the world of Hashkocha. When you live in a fortress made out of concrete, it's not so straightforward that you feel your dependency. You have to thicker your wallet, for example. The thicker your wallet is, the thicker the wall between you and feeling Hashem's Hashkocha. It takes extra sensitivity to be a person with a thick wallet and feel that it's all dependent on a higher Hashkocha. When you walk into a place that's got a thin roof, so then you are able, more easily able, when you see that it's flimsy, and you tell yourself that's what it all is. Right? And you see, the word sukkah, you know what it's based on? The word sukkah, the literal meaning, the Hebrew root sukkah, sakha means to see through. Sokhe in Hebrew means to see through. Something that's transparent, right? It says that Sarah imenu, Sarah, woman, the great woman who founded Judaism, right? Avraham Avinu, Sarah imenu. One of the names was Yiska. Kia kol sachin beyofya, because everybody could see through her beauty. What does it mean to see through her beauty? She was transparent. You know what that means? It means when you looked at her, you saw a woman. But when you looked closely, you saw Hashem. Right? And where did you see Hashem in looking at Sarah? In her sensuous womanly beauty. You know, when it says that Sarah was beautiful, it does not mean spiritually beautiful. It means she was beautiful as only a woman can be beautiful in the deepest and most intense. And you know how we know that? Because the Egyptians were interested in her. The Egyptians were prepared to kill her husband. And the Egyptians were into the lowliest of physicality. The Egyptians were not looking for women of refined spiritual elevation. They were looking for the earthiest of beauty. And she excelled in that. Which means that Sarah's greatness was that her beauty was so intense in the physical, and yet when you looked at that physical beauty, you saw Hashem. That's being transparent. Jewish women have to teach that. That's what resides in the earthiness of being a woman, holding the sensuality and the world of aesthetics and beauty as only a woman can, and refining that. That's what tzniyus means. Tzniyus means holding the world of physicality that can draw a person down into the ugliest and the most earthy and despiritualize the realities, and presenting that in such a refined way that it becomes transparent in a certain person. Only women can do that, of course. Only Jewish women can do that. And that's why women are the cracks and the key to the redemption. And that only will come from Jewish women. And that's why the name of Sarah, which is the name of womanly beauty that enables a person to transcend through the earthiness of that finite dimension and see the spirituality, that's the name of the sukkah. That's the name of the sukkah. And therefore, on this seventh day of Sukkot, which is already Shiva and Sviya, moving towards the fullness of experience after having lived in the Sukkot for 7 days, is it time to begin thinking about what we'll do when we move out of this place? Right? You have another day or two over here, and then you move out into a world, into a year which has its ups and downs, and plenty of downs. Plenty of downs. And therefore, the response we have is not depression. The response we have is not depression and uncontrolled anxiety. That's not our response. Our response is certainly serious, and certainly at times of sadness. But our response to all that is knowing that in the exertion that gets put into those things, is the experience, the possibility of a growth that comes out of those difficulties and those finite situations and those situations of seeming limitation. And it's out of those depths and those difficulties that is the real concept of Jewish simcha. That's what the Pasuk means when it says you didn't serve in happiness. It means that had you grasped the serving correctly, you would have grasped happiness. Ivdu is Hashem b'simcha. Had you grasped what Ivdu means, if you understand what it means to serve, then you'll understand it.